Blog Talk Radio.
Man, I'm so hyped right now. Anything's possible. Anything's possible!
RSD, Renegade Radio. Where real guys talk real sports. Allow me to introduce the illustrious three-man booth.
I want winners.
What's your name, boy?
Mark the Game Changer.
What's your name, boy?
D-Well.
Now, ladies and gentlemen.
T.O.T. Sports Ph.D.
The world famous.
Ray.
They are who we thought they were.
We need more dollars.
RSG, Renegade Radio. The floodgates is about to open.
Everybody has an opinion.
The man must have a code.
We're taking RSG to the next level.
Hello, you play to win the game.
You could gripe about Mike's game, but I don't see shooting percentage being hit.
I mean, I'm not griping the third overall player on my list.
Is it safe?
No, I blame it on Nintendo. It's provocative. Because we don't make excuses. You know, we're not going to make any excuses.
You need to move more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, looking in the mirror. Do I look good? I got my extra bands on. I got my other shoes on. Be a dog. Can't wait. Can you dig it, sucker?
All right, all right. Welcome to the Real Sports Guys, where real guys talk real sports. RSG, Renegade Radio. I am your host and one-third of the illustrious three-man booth, Marcus the Game Changer. I'm going to introduce the rest of the crew as we get into the proceedings this evening. But first off, I'd like to thank you for your patronage. You could have been anywhere in the world this evening, but you're right here listening to us, and we greatly appreciate that. Now, allow me to introduce my cohorts here. My man, T.O.T. Sports, Ph.D. What's happening, Captain?
This is like sports heaven, man. Just a sports Christmas with the Olympics and baseball and football ramping up. I'm just loving it. But honestly, I'm feeling like a young Kobe in my second year and at my first All-Star game, and I'm on the court with Mike. Okay, because of our guy that you're about to introduce, with no further ado.
Absolutely. With no further ado, my man PhD is referring to, we have Ray in the house. Ray is back with us tonight, sitting in for D-Wills, and it's always a great pleasure to have him in the building. This is one of the sports talk legends in our circles. His perspectives are always on point. He is always sharp-witted. So we like to give a warm RSG welcome back for my man Ray.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I miss you, fellas.
Hey, man.
You know, Tuesday nights aren't the same. So I'm glad to be back. I'm sorry that B couldn't be here tonight, but you know, he's got some things at home he better take care of.
Absolutely. And shout out to D. Wills. He's here
D-Wills.
In spirit for sure. And Mrs. D. Wills and yeah. Little Mrs. D. Wills and his
Happy
whole family out.
Yep.
They're taking care of business and doing a little family time. And you know, we're real sports guys. We all have families and other obligations. Sports radio is something that we all love, and we do it for the love. We do it for the enjoyment of it. We love to talk sports. And it's nothing like talking sports with you guys. And that's what you got here. That's what you'll be listening to for the next 2 hours. Again, you're listening to the Real Sports Guys. RealSportsGuys.com, RSG, Renegade Radio. Let me give you a quick rundown of what we have in store for you this evening. First up, we got the Punky Editorial. We're going to talk a little bit of college football, get into some of the rankings that have come out, the preseason rankings. We're going to talk about the top conferences in the country. So be on the lookout for that. We're also going to talk Olympics, a lot of Olympics this episode. So make sure you stay tuned for that. We're going to check in with the Dream Team. PhD is going to give us kind of an update, a synopsis of the last couple of games, in particular the Nigeria game, the Lithuania game, and he may touch on the Argentina game a little bit. We're going to talk about Carmelo Anthony. Then we're going to get Ray. Ray, we've all kind of weighed in on the 92 versus the 2012 team, but when you got a legend in the house with Ray, you have to let him check in and let him weigh in. So he's going to weigh in on the whole 92 versus 2012 debate. So be on the lookout for that, because I'm sure there's going to be some fireworks, a real interesting talk right there. We're also going to talk about Usain Bolt. Is he the greatest sprinter of all time? He broke his own Olympic record, ran the second fastest time in history. He owns the first fastest time in history. Is he the greatest? We're going to talk about that. We're going to dig into that particular question. We'll talk about Michael Phelps, Missy Franklin, Gabby Douglas, and all their accomplishments. We'll also talk about the Missy Franklin's conundrum. She's won four Olympic gold medals, but is choosing to not take any endorsements so she can swim with her high school team and maintain her amateurism and potentially swim in college. We're going to pose the question, if that's your daughter, what do you advise her to do? We're also going to check in on new things that we've learned about sports that, you know, are kind of off the radar. The Olympics exposes us to a lot of sports that we really don't get to see on a regular basis. And there's really some interesting stuff out there, new rules, new things that we weren't aware of that we are now being exposed to. So we're going to check in with that. Then in the five on the black-hand side, we're going to check in. We're going to do an NFL preview. We're going to take it division by division over the next couple of weeks. This week we're going to touch in with the NFC East, and we're going to give you a preview of the NFC East. And then we're going to talk about some of the awesome players, best players of all time who have suffered a career-threatening injury or injury in their prime that has really robbed them of some of their best years. Again, it's going to be inspired by Adrian Peterson. So we're going to check in on that. Get into the Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. We're going to preview next week's show, and then we're going to get into the shutdown mode. That is our show. We're going to jump right into it. And here we go.
Fellas, one thing we need to say. Yes, shall we say it, y'all? Yes, Melvin, right. Jimmy, yes. Coleman, Ryan, say it. Everybody want to get funky one more time.
All right. Now, fellas, for this week's Funky Editorial, first, I just want to check in, and I'm going to toss this one to PhD first. Really, college football is in a state of flux. This is the last year of the BCS. Conference realignment has kind of settled down a bit. You'd anticipate there's going to be some more shifting over time, but right now things have seemed to settle down for the moment. Given the kind of continental shift that's happened with college football, how do you feel about it at this particular time as far as its place in the average sports fan's kind of appointment book?
Well, I think college football always will have a special place in our hearts for a lot of different reasons. I mean, there's this huge nostalgia point of it. You know, I grew up in Michigan, so naturally I'm always going to follow Big Blue and Big Green. But if you take it a step further, you know, folks that went to college, and say if you went to a big football school, you're always going to follow them as well. So even though there's been a lot of dramatics about college football, at the end of the day, I mean, it's just like the NFL. You can have your lockout, but people are going to watch it. They're going to follow it, you know, at the end of the day. I think the changes that have been made will improve the game. And at at the end of the day, a lot of us who hold on so tight to some of these rivalries and some of these bowls in terms of the history with it, we're just going to have to let that go and move on to whatever's coming, upcoming, and embrace it.
Okay. Now, I think I agree with you. I think things have changed. This isn't your father's college football. But I think, you know, there are some things that were good about the old system that I think we want to keep. And I think there were some things that we didn't like about the way things were that I think we like to see change. Ray, what are some of those things that, you know, you think are good things that, what are the good things about college football that you enjoy?
I think that the changes in the conferences haven't changed so dramatically that you're going to lose out on any of the big rivalries that you think of. I think those games you'll still see pop up every 3 or 4 years. You know, Nebraska's not going to get rid of some of the biggest games that they could play just because they're in the Big Ten. And, you know, I think that even with a four team playoff format, those rivalries are what really drive college football anyway. And so it's that consistency that's been through all the years. Those things aren't going to – I don't see those things changing so dramatically. So that's what's going to really hold college football together while they work this out. Because right now it's a 14 format. That's not going to stay the same. It's impossible to figure out where you're going to get those four teams from and not have the same controversy you have with the BCS. So those are the good things.
I think you had a little bit of a Freudian slip there. You called it the BS instead of the BCS.
I'm sorry. It is BS. It was BS.
Exactly.
But that's the fluff we talk about. You know, how do you come down to a 14 format without having the same kind of, you know. But it was, you know, you're going to have, it's still a learning process. But you asked me what was good about it. And I think it's just that the rivalries are still there, even though some teams are out of the conference. They are still going to slip up and play those teams that they used to play just because the money's too big to ignore.
Absolutely. I think the four-team format is definitely going to – there's still going to be controversy. Whatever system that they go to, there's going to be controversy because there's always going to be some teams left out. There's going to be teams left out in the cold. And I think that's always going to cause a few problems and ruffle a few feathers and leave some teams feeling jaded at the end of the day. The four-team format, you kind of touched on it a bit, Ray. PAD, do you think it's a precursor to a bigger, larger tournament?
I do. I think at some point we'll get to eight. And the reason I think we'll get there is because there's going to be so much argument, injustice for the number 5 and 16. But the thing I look at with that is every spring in March Madness, team number 69, 70, they're outraged too. So at some point, I think that 8 is going to be it. Because at some point, teams 9 and 10, they can't make the discussion that they should be in the that they got left out of playing for a national championship. Maybe 5 and 6, maybe. But I think at some point we'll shift to 8 teams and probably stay there for a while.
Okay. Yeah, because the 4-team format is going to be interesting because you got 6 quote-unquote power conferences. And if things continue to play out the way they played out, 2 of those 4 teams are probably going to be from the SEC. So that leaves 2 spots for 5 other conferences. In this playoff system, and I foresee that being a problem.
Wait till you have 5 undefeated teams. It's possible. And what are you going to say? You know.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's not perfect. I think it's a step in the right direction, though. This whole nebulous BCS thing. Let it be decided, truly let it be decided on the field. Let the polls, if the polls are the top 4 teams and those are the top 4 teams, and let those four teams get in there and slug it out. And if number four wins, then number four won. If number one wins, then number one won. But they all had an opportunity to play for.
And I think that's what everybody has always thought. You know, once you get down to those top four, if you just look back in history, you could always make an argument that that number three team could have won a national championship had the opportunity been there for them to play for it. You know, it's just you have so many third-ranked national or third-ranked teams that are undefeated that just didn't get the opportunity to play for a national championship. So it'll work its way out.
Yeah, it will. Yeah, it will. It'll definitely work its way out. Now, let's get into the college football preseason top 25 rankings. The rankings are out. The top five teams, you know, preseason rankings always come out every year. And there's always a couple of teams who are in the top 25 who wind up falling out. There's always a couple of top five teams who don't finish the season as top five teams. I'm going to go through the top five teams. Give me your initial impressions of this year's top five. Who do you think will stick, and who do you think may slide out? Number one, we got LSU. Number two, they got Alabama. Number three, they got USC. Number four, Oklahoma. And number five, the Oregon Ducks. Now, just outside that top five, you got Georgia at six, Florida State at seven, Michigan at eight, South Carolina at nine, and Arkansas at 10. Now, I'm going to do a quick count. That's one, two, three, four, five. Five SEC teams in the top 10. So, again, I'll recap the top five. Give me your impressions. LSU 1, Alabama 2, USC 3, Oklahoma 4, Oregon 5. What are your impressions? Who's staying? Who's gonna finish in the top five at the end of the season? And who's most likely to drop out? Go ahead, Ray. Why don't you jump in with that one first?
Well, the first team that I think that could drop out and don't understand fully yet why they're there is Oregon. You know, they still have questions at quarterback. So, you know, to be that highly ranked and to have questions at quarterback, I don't know that they'll be there at the end of the year. I don't see them going into a 14 format next year. If this were next year, how's that?
Okay. Now, who do you say you like staying?
Well, I like LSU staying.
Okay.
I certainly like LSU staying, but Alabama, USC, I don't know. I when I look at Oregon, I have questions about that.
Okay. All right. I think that's a fair assessment. Oregon, of these teams, I think is the team that is probably their style lends itself to kind of a loss here or there. Their style isn't a style that you can go into anywhere and win with. And they've proven that over time where they've had some ugly losses. And I think when you think of Oregon, some of those games where they've lost to teams that they shouldn't have lost to really stick out to you. Or they've been inconsistent. And that really sticks out to you as well. The four programs ahead of Oregon are pretty sound brands when you look at who's ahead of them. PhD, you're most likely to stay, you're most likely to fall out.
I think USC is most likely to stay primarily because of their schedule. Outside of Oregon, I think they can win every game they play in. And then the team that I think can creep in is actually out just slightly outside the top 10 for me, and that's West Virginia. I think they're going to make some noise in their new conference. And honestly, I really like this kid, Geno Smith, their quarterback, originally from Miami. I had the opportunity to see him play multiple times in high school. And I mean, he's just an amazing athlete. And I think at some point he's going to emerge as a front runner for the Heisman Trophy this year. I don't know if he'll win it, but I think he'll have a 3 or 4 game stretch that we're going to be thinking, wow, this guy really needs to be in the discussion. So I think West Virginia at some point might make the top four, if not really, really make some noise, bust into that top five.
Okay. Now, West Virginia is moving to the Big 12 this year. Geno Smith is an excellent quarterback, a bit of a dual threat, but he's more of a passer. He definitely kind of hangs his hat on being more of a passer, but he can move. They got a lot of speed. It's going to be interesting to see how they their first time through the Big 12. It's going to be a high, nice to meet you game every time, every week, for the most part, where the other teams aren't super familiar with their system. They're not super familiar with what the other teams run. I actually think they may have a slight advantage over some of the other teams because of their – they've been in the spread style for quite some time. They've had this system in place for a long time, whereas some of the other programs in the Big 12 that have begun to run a kind of a spread offensive system, like in Oklahoma State, have just begun to instill it. So it's not as deep or as deeply instilled in the program's culture. So I think you're going to see them run it a little bit better and run it in a way that maybe at a pace maybe that the Big 12 hasn't seen. So that's an interesting pick because I think they are going to make some noise in the Big 12. I don't know if they'll get up to top four, but I definitely can see why you got them going there. My team that I picked, my team most likely to stay is Alabama. I think they are going to creep up into that one spot and sit on it for a while. The defense is nasty. They're starting to become a running back factory. You know, you had Trent Richardson last year, Mark Ingram the year before. Lacy this year is just as good as those two guys and is going to be a monster. Their quarterbacks are solid. If they ever get a kid who's a upper echelon, elite-level college quarterback, that's going to be a scary program because you know the defense is going to bring it week in and week out. And that's a low-level pro defense right there. I mean, that defense probably ranked 27th, 28th in the NFL. So Alabama, I got staying. Falling out, I got Oklahoma falling out. Oklahoma, you know, I think they have a schedule where they have some obstacles. You know, Texas, Oklahoma State, those are rivalry games that are always going to be on their schedule. You also got West Virginia at West Virginia. You got TCU at TCU. You got Notre Dame on the schedule this year. Those are some tough games. That's a bit of a gauntlet, you know, that they got to run through. Plus, they play Baylor at home. They have Baylor at home, but still, those are some tough games. And I think they're good for one of those losses. And unless you're just lights out in any other conference, you can't have necessarily one loss. Only conference I think where you can get a one-loss team in a national championship game is the SEC. Because there's going to be one team with a loss in the SEC. If there's 2 one-loss SEC teams, I think they can get the nod most of the time. That's how much respect that conference gets. Which leads us into our next question in this funky editorial. What is going to be the best conference in 2012? Ray, I want to toss that to you first. Which of the Power Six at least are going to be the best conferences?
I think you just said it. You know, I think that you know the flux of some of the other conferences. If you look at you know the Big Ten don't have a team in the top seven. You know, so. I think you hit it right on the head, and that they're the only conference where you can get a loss and still, you know, stick your chest out and tell them bring it, you know. So that would be the conference of choice for me.
Okay. All right. So you're going with the SEC, PhD. What conference do you feel like is the best conference?
SEC, period.
Yeah. And I got to agree. I don't think there's very much debate. Football, college football in particular, is just different down there. It's just different. It's a different level of intensity. and there's a reason, because they're good. The conference, top to bottom, is legit. It's legit. It's tough. The conference that I think approaches it a bit with the addition of West Virginia, with TCU coming into the fold, is the Big 12. When you have West Virginia, Texas, Oklahoma State, Oklahoma, TCU, that conference begins to look a little bit tougher. Still not top to bottom, because there are some pretty easy games in that conference when you're talking about Iowa State or Kansas. But even Kansas State is becoming more competitive. The Big Ten is always tough. But again, Penn State's going to disappear for a minute. They're going to go into witness protection for a couple of years. We don't know what they look like, are going to look like. Purdue has been down for a while. Northwestern is iffy. Illinois has been shaky. So there's some programs in the Big Ten that are also shaky. You know, at the top is pretty sound. You got OSU, The Ohio State University, Michigan, Big Blue. You got Wisconsin. Penn State was at fourth king. And now I think Nebraska slides into that spot.
Luckily.
I mean, those are, and you're right. You know, it's a good thing they did at Nebraska, because they would be hurting as far as their rating and their standing and the perception of that conference overall over the next couple of years. So that does it for this edition for the Funky Editorial. You're listening to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, RSG, Renegade Radio. Now we're going to talk about the Olympics. All right, first, we're going to check in with the Dream Team. I'm going to pass it over to my man, PhD. He's going to walk us through this. I'm going to give him a few prompts, and he's going to roll with it. So the first thing I want to talk about is PhD. Give us your breakdown of the Nigeria game. I mean, 83-point win. An 83-point victory for Team USA. Big shot lights out. I think 71% from the three-point range. Carmelo Anthony had one of the best games I've ever seen him play. He dropped 37 in 14 minutes. No, really, 37 points in 14 minutes. He even added a Jordan shrug. That's how hot he was. So break that down for the listeners out there in a way only you can. Put on your Hubie Brown hat. What went right in the Nigeria game for Team USA?
Everything. Everything. Okay. It was fun to watch. It was a lot of fun to watch to a certain degree. One of the things I found really interesting was that Coach K, when he was asked at the end of the game, you know, somebody had to ask, well, you know, are you running up the score? You know, this is the Olympics. What about sportsmanship? And Coach K just said, listen, wait a minute. We had numbers five or six times in the fourth quarter, and we just pulled it back. It didn't even go fast breaking. You know, we're shooting three-pointers. They're going in. We've got a couple of shot clock violations. I mean, we have to shoot. There's a shot clock. So I think in a lot of regards, they did everything they could to keep it close and respectable. You know, LeBron didn't play much in the second half, if at all. I mean, they were doing their thing. And Carmelo, you know, we've all said it. His game is designed. It is patented. It is made for international play, especially with the three-point line being pushed in. He's one of the best, if not the best, mid-range shooter in the world. And mid-range for him is, you know, the equivalent of the international three-point line. So I think this is why we're seeing he and Durant play so solid. So for me, that's why they were so good against Nigeria.
Okay. Yeah, and, you know, when you talk about the Coach K comments, it reminds me of the year the Patriots had Randy Moss. And they were scoring ridiculous amounts of points. And people were coming at Belichick like, you know, why are you running up the score? And he was like, you know, what do you want me to do, kick a field goal? It's still points. You know what I'm saying? It's like we give them a chance to stop us. We go for it on fourth down. If they stop us, we don't get any points. If I kick a field goal, we still get points. You know, and I think that's the kind of mentality Coach K had, was like, look, we're shooting three-pointers. This is the toughest shot in the game, and this is what we're shooting. They're going in. What do you want us to do? You know?
Right.
So it's a very welcome conundrum for a coach when you're just scoring too much. Now, on the flip side, they have a dog fight against Lithuania, which has always given Team USA fits historically. This time around, they led going into the last 6 minutes. Lithuania had a 2-point lead, and then LeBron took over. And he did what he's supposed to do as the best player on the planet. He got after it. They got it going, and they pulled out the victory, which is really all that matters. But if you could, PAZ, break down kind of where Team USA kind of got caught in a jam in this particular game.
Well, I guess with Lithuania, this is in large part a very similar team that gave us big time problems in 2004 and in 2008. Marcus, I'm going to lean on you for a second. What's the guy's name who played at Maryland that's from Lithuania?
Jesikevicius.
Yeah.
Durant is Jesikevicius.
There you go. they move the ball around so crispy. And think about it. In most situations, these guys aren't defensive stoppers, talking about the USA Olympic team. These guys are out there to score. Now, there are a few exceptions of guys who play exceptional defense in the NBA, but in general, what you have is pretty much an NBA All-Star team out there. I mean, the defense isn't that bad, but it's nowhere as intense as you're going to see in June in playoff time. So in a lot of regards, teams that can play the pick and roll, they move the ball around, they're getting good shots around, like on Team USA. We saw this for Argentina and when they played in the friendly, not this most recent game, but when they played in the friendly, teams are getting good shots against them. And teams that have good perimeter shooters, which are all the top-tier international teams, including their bigs, they're going to give the Team USA some trouble. Now, the thing that is going to help Team USA is that you can't live and die by your outside jump shot consistently. I mean, you just can't live on that throughout a tournament. You're going to have some games where you're hot, and that's shooting 50%, 45%, 55% against Team USA. But in general, you know, you're not going to be able to do that every night. Where Team USA, to answer your question directly, they got away from who they were in terms of attacking the basket. Kobe Bryant, in my opinion, was taking too many contested jump shots. I know somewhere Justin Page is turning in his sleep. and LeBron wasn't being aggressive enough and being too complacent until the second half. So, you know, I think it's going to be a tough medal round for them because a lot of these teams they're going to be facing, they're going to get good shots if they move the ball around on Team USA. And Team USA just has to continue to be diligent on the offensive end and not rely too much on their outside jumpers.
Yeah, I think Team USA, Lithuania was sound with the ball for the most part. They didn't give Team USA a whole lot in the way of turnovers, and that's what the rest of the tournament is going to look like. You're going against guards who are a little bit more sound with the rock. They're not going to give it up as much. And so a lot of those easy breakaway opportunities that they get are not going to be there. And so they're going to have to, as the ball movement improves, they're going to have to do a better job of manufacturing offense in the half court. And I think you're right. They have to continue to attack. If you're going to play small, then you have to use that quickness advantage by attacking the rim as much as you can, pulling those bigs away and going to the basket instead of settling for Jay. So I think you're spot on with that analysis. Now, go ahead.
I think this is probably the best collection of professional basketball talent we've ever seen outside of the 92 Dream Team. You know, so there's no reason why these guys can't be successful if they stick to what they do well.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely, I agree. And that statement that you just made, I think, is a very provocative statement. You know, it's provocative. It gets the people going, as we like to say around these parts. Because, you know, you talk about the assemblance of talent, and that's an assemblance of talent minus a Dwight Howard, minus Chris Bosh, minus a Derrick Rose, minus a Dwayne Wade, guys who would even elevate this team to another level. You know, if this team had all of its parts, we could have a very different conversation. But given where it is and the talk that's surrounding this team, that began with Kobe's statement, which was followed up by LeBron's statement. And let me be clear, I don't think any of us faults them for saying what they said as far as them being able to beat the Dream Team. As a competitor, as somebody who plays sports, we all play sports. If somebody asks you if you could beat another team, you're going to say, hey, you know, we gonna get out there, we're going to give it a shot. Yeah, I think we can give them a go. You're not going to say, yeah, they kick our butts. Nobody's going to say that. So I don't fault those guys for saying what they said. They answered the question that was asked of them. But we got to entertain our population. And in the vein of doing that, we got to talk about whether or not 92 could beat 2012. And Ray hasn't had an opportunity to weigh in on air. I'm sure he's weighed in several times in different venues across the state line area. But he hasn't had a chance to weigh in on our airwaves. So we want to offer him that opportunity. Again, you're listening to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, RSU Renegade Radio. Ray, 92 versus 2012, who you got?
Right, I still got 92. And only because the talent level of that team is certainly comparison to the talent level on this team. The biggest exception and the biggest thing that if you never saw those guys play, like I got a chance to see them play, you'd realize that what the NBA was in 92 and the team aspect of what your role was and how you played it, it fits right into what Phil was talking about with Lithuania. You know, Lithuania plays well because that ball is snapped freshly off of those fingertips to that player to make that shot, to play that role. And I think that this Dream Team, this team that we're talking about today, had never, these guys have never played, in my opinion, that team concept kind of ball. And everyone on that 92 team had somebody on their team that they probably felt should have been on that team with them. You know, there were only a few teammates, true teammates on that team. And so having said that, those guys came from, you know, some teams that that truly played team basketball, understood what team basketball was all about, and understood what it took, you know, to break another team down if they had to. These young men are as talented as individual basketball players as you'll ever see. But that's the difference that I really see in the NBA today. The difference that I remember from what the NBA used to be about. And so to think that you have a talent level that's roughly the same and not able to compete. No, I think that 92 team would ate them up.
Okay. PhD, you fall on the other side of this on the other side of this debate. I'm gonna let you weigh in.
Yeah, you know, honestly, the point that Ray made that stings me the most, that is gonna cripple my argument the most, is the ball movement piece. And you're right, Team USA and, you know, 92 Dream Team, that's the one thing that just struck me the most, how crispy the ball movement was.
Sure.
And from a talent standpoint, here's the way I look at it. Whenever you have a talent like Michael Jordan, I don't care if you're the 87 Bulls or the 96 Bulls. Whenever you have somebody like him that you can run out you got a shot to win in a one game. You got a shot. Because this guy is just so uniquely gifted where he can take over a game. He's a matchup issue. You just have a shot in a one-game situation. Now, I put LeBron James in that same exact category.
Sure.
Because of his blend and the way we saw him play in the finals. And, yes, we're taking the 2012 Team USA where LeBron just dominated a couple of weeks ago. Or a couple of months ago. And when you have a player like LeBron who can take over the game and is such a matchup nightmare, can do so many different things, I think he too is the type of player like Jordan that his team has a shot to win on any given night.
Okay.
But herein lies your problem, Phil. Here at your feet lies that problem. On any given night, Jordan could have fell over, and one of those other players, because of the team concept that this team would have played, would have still figured out how to win. Now you can fall on Carmelo. They have the talent is still there, the mindset to react to that fallout would have been completely different. That 92 team would have reacted immediately. Michael could have missed three shots and Magic wouldn't have threw him the ball anymore. Okay. Let LeBron miss three shots and he's still waving for it and he's still getting it. And then 92 team would have been like, wait a minute. We do this night in and night out. We do this every day. We play team ball. That's what we do. Larry Bird would have been on fire. You know, that team was actually a lot older than this team.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of those players that you saw were not in their prime like you see these guys. These guys are dead set in their prime.
I would argue that, Ray, because I've actually looked at it. Most of those guys are in their sixth or seventh year. Most of them were in their sixth or seventh year, which is right in the middle of your prime. They were older because they were 29. Mike was 29. Chuck was 28. Karl Malone was 28. Ewing was 28. The only cats over 30 were.
Bird
was 35, but we know Bird wasn't logging minutes. Magic was 32. Those were the old heads.
Sure.
They were 32
sure.
and 35. Everybody else
sure.
was right in the throes of their prime.
Well, I think that when you play every night in the NBA now with a three-man roster and two players that you could pick up at a laundromat on the way, it's hard for you to think that you really could understand what those old boys would have done to you.
Now, Ray, you raised an argument that we haven't heard before. Now, I'll kind of break down the arguments for the listeners out there real quick, and I'm going to let the fellas continue to have at it for another couple of minutes. Now, on the side of the 92, you had the argument of size, skill, post play and Jordan. That's one argument. There's a Jordan argument. There's a size, and then there's a skill argument. With this other team, with 12, you got athleticism. You have LeBron, and then I think there you have the perimeter D. The pressure that the perimeter defense of the 12 team will be able to apply. Because outside of Stockton, now Stockton wasn't a slouch. I think Stockton gets discounted because I think people look at Steve Nash and don't realize Stockton was a two-way player in the true sense of it. And I think people think he was like a Steve Nash because Steve Nash gets compared to him because they're white. But he didn't play that Nash kind of game where he played both ends, and he played both ends really well. but I think he gets kind of discounted. Now, he would have took care of the ball. Do you think the pressure that the 12 team would be able to apply on the perimeter to Magic and to Stockton would have been able to give them some sort of an advantage in the game between the 92 team and the 12 team, Ray?
No. No. And again, you know, when you talk about these eras and when you talk about training, when you talk, you know, you have to keep it in mind and perspective that as the young athletes today eat better, sleep better, have so much more control, and you can't discount what these other players might have done. When you have an argument about would Tyson have beaten Ali, no. Why? Because Tyson grew up in an era with a whole different set of opportunities for athleticism and getting into condition and strength and everything else. So it's still that mindset. It's still could you, again, are there as many dogs on this team as there were on that team? Uh-uh. Not just cold-hearted dogs, you know. Just that whole era was a lot of teams that truly had some rivalries. You know, these players, if it weren't for the Dream Team, they really, except for Magic, who seemed to be the diplomat of all the NBA, that they really didn't like each other, you know. They just respected each other, game in and game out. Now these cats calling each other to see where you're going to play next year. I might go join you. You might have a decision.
I think you don't like that.
I don't like that at all. I can't like you that much, you know.
Right.
I don't want to play against you, you know.
Ray, I got a question for you. Ray, do you still blame it on Nintendo?
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, these young guys are playing the kind of game that the market is serving. You know, a guy like LeBron, you know, he ain't sitting out there dreaming about making that game-winning shot and having the crowd go crazy. You know, he's dreaming about, you know, how many endorsements that's going to bring. You know, he wants that shot to get paid. Jordan, he wanted to stab you in the heart. He wanted to send you home crying.
Yeah, I agree. So one more quick exercise, and then we're gonna end this debate. So I got you two fellas. I'm gonna give Ray the first pick. You can take a player from any teams. Each of you is gonna get a five, and we're gonna see what we come up with. All right. So each of you gets a five. Ray gets the first pick. Filthy, you follow up. Go ahead.
You pulled out my old analogy, and I would take LeBron. At his size and his ability, I'd have to. I ain't no fool.
Okay, so you got LeBron with the first pick. Phil T, you get 2 and 3. You get the second pick and the third pick, so we're going to snake it. All right? So who are your next two, Phil?
Jordan. And Durant.
Jordan and Durant. So you got Jordan and Durant. Yeah, you got LeBron. Who you taking next?
I'm taking Charles Barkley. I'm taking Magic.
Okay. Barkley and Magic. So LeBron and Magic are the same team. How you gonna counter that, PhD?
I'm going Ewing and Robinson because I'm taking my ball and I'm going home.
All right, you got Ray. Ray, you got two.
That's it, right there. We'll just leave it at that. You understand my point. You understand my point. Now you understand my point.
So looking at that brief draft, we had two players from the current 12 team taken. Two. When I let you cats do your thing, you took two cats from the current 12 team. Everybody else is from 92. I just wanted to throw that out there. So if we was at a pick, we was at a park, and we finna run pickups. Two cats from the 92 team is running in the game.
Yeah, and, you know, I just want to make it clear because, you know, I think I proved, I made the strongest argument against my own point.
Yeah.
By taking the two big guys. It takes so many guys from 92, but the text messages are rolling in. I want to make it clear. In a seven-game series, I think the 92 team wins. Four games of three, four games of two, you name it.
Sure.
But in a one-game tournament game, in a one game, that's my thing. I think it's up for grabs.
But see, then you're still counting on LeBron to do something that nobody in the NBA ever during his time could do to Michael Jordan. You're counting on that. I wouldn't count on that for nothing. I would never count on that for nothing.
And that's the Jordan argument. Six and on the finals.
Because LeBron just ain't that dog yet.
Yeah.
He's had plenty of time. And not in a one game. Not when you just say this is it. I just wouldn't discount a Michael Jordan at all. I just couldn't.
I would go the other way
with a seven game. Because I think that team concept could break down. And you just can't chase all the talent that's on this team. You know. Because we completely discounted Carmelo Anthony, and in this format, like you said, this is a monster, a complete monster, and you just can't discount him like that. I would have gone the other way. In a one game, I would take that 92 team in a heartbeat.
So you take 12 in a seven game?
I'm sorry?
You take 12 in a seven game series?
Only because of the athleticism and you know, they again that 92 team had the talent, but the age spread was too great. To me, the age spread was too great. Now you give me a 27-year-old Larry Bird, you give me a 27-year-old Magic Johnson, and put them on that team, then I'd say, okay, we got something to talk about. But this team,
well, on the other
side
of that, Ray, I say, give me a 31-year-old LeBron James.
Okay, all right.
Because I think a 31-year-old LeBron James is going to have three rings by that point. It is going to be legitimate in a conversation with Jordan.
Okay, but only because, you know, in the offseason you make a phone call and see who's playing where. These guys just showed up.
And we'll close it out on that note.
All right.
We'll close it out on that note. You're listening to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, RNC Renegade Radio. We're talking Dream Team, talking the Olympics. Now, I want to move the conversation a little bit to the track. Usain Bolt broke his own Olympic record this week, ran a 9.63 to set a new Olympic record in 100 meters. He's going to be competing in the 200 tomorrow, in the 200 final. I think there only has been one other male athlete to repeat as the fastest man in the world. And Usain has done it in convincing fashion two times. The first time he won, he beat everybody so bad that he celebrated the last about, I don't know, 10 to 15 meters of the race. You know, he still broke the world record at that time. Later on to break it again on his own world record, and then this time he broke his own record that he set at the Olympics in 08. So the brother's fast. We have to begin to ask ourselves, is he the greatest sprinter of all time? Just given what we know about the way the sport operates and the way the sport works, is he the greatest sprinter of all time? I'm going to throw it to you, PhD. What do you think about that statement?
I think he is certainly in the conversation. And I'll throw out a couple other folks. You know, the Jesse Owens, I mean, the historical context and just what he accomplished in that era is something that is too much for me to say that Bolt's the best. But more recently, I would counter with Michael Johnson. Because what we saw him do, and again, I'm saying that 400 meters and under are considered sprinters, what he did in the 400 and the 200 in Atlanta in 96, as well as what he did in Sydney. I mean, we saw him do some stuff that was just unbelievable.
Yeah,
and he left people in the dust. I mean, he left folks in the dust, man, just like Bolt did. Bolt has a different type of swag to him, though. And Michael Johnson, just like Michael Phelps, Michael Johnson was, I mean, he was the talk, man. Everybody was talking about him in them gold shoes. You know, just like everybody was waiting for that 100-meter race, everybody was waiting for the 200 and 400, man, back in 96 because of this cat. So I would say that Bolt is certainly in the conversation. If you press me, I'll say no, he's not the best of all time. But he's certainly a 1B, a 1C. He's certainly right there with what we've seen Owens do and Michael Johnson.
Ray, you have a long-range perspective on this.
Sure.
Bill brought up some great sprinters, and Michael Johnson and
yeah.
Jesse Owens. And I remember 96. I never seen Jesse Owens run. I'm not there. But I understand the impact of what the conditions that Jesse Owens did what he did under, which
sure.
I think when we talk, especially on this show, we talk about mental toughness and the dog meter all the time. To go against what he was going against and to face what Jesse Owens faced at that particular time and to win and what his wins represented was tremendous. It was tremendous and had a lasting impact. And Michael Johnson was, as Phil said it, he was that dude. He was the dude that everybody waited to see. Long term, how do you see Bolt fitting into the pantheon of sprinters?
I see that as well. And I think the thing that separated Jesse Owens and Carl Lewis, you know, you can't forget Carl Lewis and to remember what all they were doing when they went to the Olympics. I think that if you're just going to ask me who the best sprinter was, I would have to say Usain Bolt, if not for this Olympics, but certainly for the last, because of the way he just left everybody. This is all the world has to offer, and he could have stood there. He should have just ran through and high-fived everybody when they came by. He was that far ahead. You know, good race. You gave it your best. You know, did you ever remember Olympics like that? Where they're in the 100 meters, we're not talking about a 200 or a 400, which we still call sprints, but certainly, you know, you have some time to get that far ahead of somebody. This cat did it in 100 meters. He just left everybody, you know, like, to me, that's when you just talk about a pure sprinter. When you talk about a Jesse Owens in the climate that he competed in, you know, the stress that he was under. That's a whole different thing, you know. And then to perform the way that he did, and to just do his thing in four different events, that were different. You know, the long jump is a different event. If he just sprinted, would he have had that? Would he have ran down, you know, and saluted everybody, you know, on the way through? If all he had to worry about is just running, you know. But you ask who the best sprinter is, I say it's Usain Bolt. Nobody leaves people behind like that. You know, he was in a whole nother race.
Yeah. I tend to lean towards Usain Bolt myself. And the reason I would give him the advantage, Michael Johnson was amazing. Me saying Usain Bolt's the greatest sprinter of all time, in my opinion, is not – a slight to Michael Johnson at all. But the reason I give Usain the nod is because Usain Bolt is 6'5". And in whatever race he's in, and they broke this down today during the telecast, for him to get from point A to point B takes him less steps because of his strides than anybody he will compete against. He takes, in 100, he takes 41 steps. The next fastest guy, Johan Blake, took 46. So there's a physiological advantage that Usain Bolt has that as long as he takes care of his body, which he does well enough. You know what I mean?
When you get a chance, go back go back and look at the last Olympics when he left everybody and realize everybody was already standing up. You know, he was already, before he even stood up, he had left them. You know, right out of the block, before he had actually got to his running height to where he, you know, was going to really start running, everybody else is already standing up and behind. I mean, it's just a phenomenon. It's, you know, you have to talk about him in the same way you would talk about Michael Phelps in those last Olympics. Just dominated. And to come back and do it again this year as a second, you know, for the second time, to just win, not just win, but to set another record, it's just, it's unheard of.
So, you know, that if you have opinions on that, listeners out there, feel free to check us out at Twitter, at Real Sports Guys on Facebook, Real Sports Guys at Facebook, or hit us up on realsportsguys.com. You can check us out there. If you have a beef, you can hit us up each individually on Facebook. If you're Facebook friends with us, you can also do that. All right? But, you know, it's an interesting argument. It's an interesting place to put a guy. He's performed at a super high level for the last two Olympics. Again, only one other guy has repeated as the fastest man in the world in 100 meters. I think if he could up the ante if he broke Michael Johnson's record in the 200. If he does that, then I think he really ups the ante on this debate and really forces himself into that conversation with Carl Lewis, Michael Johnson. I think he has some physical gifts that we haven't seen in a sprinter in a long time with that size, that sort of height and that speed combination, which I think is something that we haven't seen. Moving on and still talking Olympics, we're going to touch on three people real quick. First, though, we're going to talk a little Michael Phelps. Now, Michael Phelps, I lost count. I think he's at 21. All right, I think he's at 21 medals. He's had a ridiculous number of medals in his career. He is a phenomenon upon himself at this particular point. Everybody had their eyes on him when he went to swim in the pool this Olympics, last Olympics. You know, he's been doing this since 2000, since the Sydney Olympics, he's been swimming. Over that time, again, he's accumulated the most medals out of any Olympian in history, the most decorated Olympian. The question I'm going to pose to you, and I'm going to throw this to Ray first. Michael Phelps, greatest Olympian of all time. What's your opinion on that?
Sure. I think the medal count alone would lead you to believe that. You know, I mean, how can you argue that? Greatest Olympian of all time. You know, over the course of his athletic career, he worked. The man put in work.
I think you said it. He put in work. He put in work. But I'm gonna ask the question. I'm gonna ask PhD to give me his opinion on that statement. Michael Phelps, greatest Olympic athlete of all time.
Cannot play with him. Cannot win with him. Cannot coach with him. Can't do it. I want winners.
I tell you what, fellas, this guy's a winner. You know, 22 medals. Yes, he is easily the greatest Olympic athlete of all time. 18 gold medals. That's twice as much to the next highest person. He's got 11 gold medals in an individual event. So those saying that, well, his relays have inflated his number of medals. Well, everybody who's high on that medal list, typically, you know, you can make that argument again. So, you know, I think Michael Fred Phelps II is certainly the greatest Olympic athlete of all time.
Okay. Now, there are those who have made the argument that if he were to be second, he would be second to Carl Lewis. Now, Carl Lewis had 10 Olympic medals. 9 of those medals were gold, and Carl competed in 3 different events in track and field, 100-meter dash, 200 meters, and a long jump. What do you think about that statement, PhD, that Carl Lewis is the greatest and Michael Phelps may be a step behind? And the reason people are saying that is because of the amount of goals, the amount of medals you can accumulate in swimming. In no other sport can you accumulate that because of the many different races that there are in swimming.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of water in that argument because, you know, I would throw in a fourth event that Carl did. Carl has two gold medals in the 4x100 as well, relay.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I just don't think that holds a lot of water. You know, I think there's a lot of holes. It's a Swiss cheese type of argument. Now, I think one piece, as you could argue, is that track and field athletes, especially sprinters, are probably better athletes than swimmers in terms of all-around athletes. But if you're looking at their craft, I don't care what you are. You're a CEO, you're a basketball player. When you dominate your craft like that, you're the best. And so in my opinion, I think that's why Michael Phelps is the best Olympic athlete ever. Now, you know, we're not shaking a stick at Carl Lewis because, like the intro say, he's second on my list, okay? So I'm not dogging him. You know, I'm not dogging him, but, you know, when you put him against Phelps, it's just really tough to argue those 22 medals.
Ray, where do you stand on that particular argument that Carl Lewis should be viewed as the greatest Olympic athlete over Michael Phelps?
I can understand that. I can understand, you know, the diversity and the training that goes into, you know, to handling those field events. But you could again plot back to the argument of Phelps and the different strokes. I have never swam. You know, I have a daughter that's a swimmer, and she'll tell you that the training you do to be, you know, a great breaststroke swimmer, and the swimming that you do, the training that you do to be a good butterfly swimmer, is just different. And so, you know, the concentration and the conditioning and everything that's involved, you know, no one's going to argue that Carl Lewis is not mentioned as one of the greatest Olympic athletes. But if Carl Lewis, you know, it would have, you know, I couldn't think of many other events that Carl Lewis could have been in. I mean, the training that he did and what he used his speed and he used his strength to do what he did in track and field. I think Phelps did the same thing. He just did it longer and did it and had more opportunity.
Well said. Well said. Now, moving along to our next Olympian that we want to highlight, Missy Franklin. Missy Franklin has won 5 medals. She's also a swimmer. 5 medals this Olympics. This is her first. She's a 17-year-old swimmer from Colorado. Four of those 5 medals are gold. She's really become kind of the new darling of the swimming world. Missy Franklin has a bit of a conundrum right now. Well, not so much a conundrum. She kind of has her mind made up. You know, there's a lot of money on the table given her success at these Olympic Games in endorsements that she's passing up in order to maintain her amateur status so that she can swim with her high school team and also possibly swim in college. She's talked about going on recruiting visits. She's thinking about going to Georgia, Florida, Texas, amongst other schools to swim. Now, I'm going to throw this out there to you fellas. If this is your child, how do you advise her in regards to, does she take this money that's on the table? Because, again, the success that she's having it happens every 4 years, and it's not guaranteed. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that she can take advantage of. But then also, you only get to – you got 4 years of eligibility in college to do whatever sport you're going to do. You only get to be in high school once. So there's definitely a pull in both directions. How would you advise Missy Franklin, if this was your daughter, Ray?
Get paid. Go get your money. Go get your money. Who you fooling? You know, what are you going to do, swim with one arm in high school? You ain't going to use your feet? What you going to do? You know, I mean, she's competed at the highest level possible. So I think that it's a very noble gesture. But unlike male swimmers, you know, you don't see the female swimmers with that kind of longevity. She may not get this chance again. Things happen. You know, women's bodies will change. She, you know, if I'm her father, I'm asking her what she really wants. And the endorsements will pay for Florida State. The endorsements will pay for, she need not worry about scholarship or anything else. She needs to take this opportunity to put herself in a position to go ahead and get paid. Because just to be able to go out and be on the swim team in high school and to be on a swim team in college, those are things you can probably afford to miss if you are looking at having, you know, the financial resources to do whatever else it is you want to do in your life. You know, they're not going to remember her until she loses her first high school swim. You know, nobody's going to be impressed with what she can do right now.
Yeah, she better not lose that first high school swim. That's going to be a problem.
Right. I mean, you won't see her in the news. Ain't nobody tuning in to watch her swim in high school. She really must think that she has Michael Phelps potential to be, you know, coming back and back and back.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk to PhD. What's your feedback on that? You're Mr. Franklin. What are you going to tell Missy as far as how should she navigate this situation?
Well, you know, it's kind of like the argument we make all the time of, tennis players and basketball players, you know, as far as when they declare to be pros, should they be given the right to come right out of high school? Why is it okay with one sport and one demographic class, but it's not for another sport and demographic class? I personally admire what her parents and family have encouraged her to do. But you also have to look at it from the context of, you know, her dad is an executive. He played some professional football. Her mother is a physician. So, you know, one can make a logical argument that the family's financial situation probably wasn't a huge decision or factor in, well, Missy, you need to do this because financially you can help us, or you can help the family have longevity financially. So I think that probably played a big part of it. And again, you know, just because of what she accomplished now, she will always have an opportunity to be a college coach as far as swimming, get an opportunity to do television if that's what she wants to do in terms of swimming broadcasting. Just because her name will always resonate amongst the swimming community and even the general population of just sports fans who watch swimming every 4 years like myself. So I think she's going to have a ton of opportunities. You know, Mary Lou Retton, you know, she makes $500,000 a year still, 20, 30 years after the fact. So, you know, I really admire what the decision she and or her parents made for her to kind of stay on course. You know, Ray, I mean, both of you guys make some solid points. You know, she's not going to get no competition in high school. But all three of us know that there's so much more in high school than just athletics, you know.
Sure.
So, and then the college experience, too. You know, I look at it like Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods' parents encouraged him to do college, you know, and he did that for a few years. And even though he was a prodigy and everybody knew, you know, I mean, as soon as he came out, he started winning PGA events. And, he could have done that a year or two before. So,
but that,
you know, I think
but
it
that,
goes
but
into the personal development. So that's why I really admire what her family has done here.
I understand, but that analogy still doesn't hold water when there ain't no swimming that's going to pay you. Like, you know, Tiger won events and was winning events when he was still in college. You know, Tiger was in the mix all the while. Everybody knew that as soon as he declared, you know, and became a pro, he was going to get paid. But this young lady in 3 years could be, you know, totally out of the sport. And,
yeah.
You know, short of signing autographs at the Piggly Wiggly, you know, what is she really going to do? And how is she going to cash in on it at that time? It's one of those things. I think that it's a very noble gesture, and I think that it's easy for her executive father to say, "Don't worry about the money." But the fact of the matter is that, you know, she might be making the kind of money that she could fire Dad. You know, nobody said what the executive he was. And so I think I don't think you leave that kind of money on the table. It's life altering money that she could be talking about. 4 years from now, she's not gonna get the same phone calls if she's not swimming Olympic events. Right now the phone's probably ringing off the hook.
I want to take the conversation in a different direction. You know, I coach female athletes, and, you know, a lot of research out there says females engage in athletics to build friendships and for the social aspect of it and not so much the competition. And I think that's what you see in this particular situation. I think you see an element of that play out. And I won't say that's the whole situation, but I think there's an element of that playing out. When you have Missy Franklin wanting to go back and swim with her high school teammates, I think it speaks to that idea and that concept that female athletes tend to gravitate towards athletics less for the competitive aspect of it that guys go for, and more for the camaraderie and being a part of a team and the social aspect of it, which is fine and dandy. I don't have a problem with that. What I would say, though, is that if Missy Franklin were a boy, I think in today's climate, we would approach her very differently if she was going to go back to high school to swim against lesser competition. We would question her dog meter if she was a guy.
Right.
But because she's a young lady, we don't question that. So that's an interesting social dynamic that I see playing out here. Because if it was a boy, if this was Phelps, and he was like, "Yeah, I'm not going to go pro, because I'm going to go swim and get some tomato cans in high school, I'm gonna bust open," then we looking at him like, "Yo, why would you even do that? Like, you can beat everybody. You're an Olympic champion. You're the best in the world. Of course, you can beat the best in your little high school conference." You know what I'm saying?
If you look at a high school swim team, a boys team and a girls team, when you look at the Olympic teams, the male and female teams, when you look at the gymnastics teams, all of those female teams, all of those women teams are a lot closer. Not to say that those male swimmers, you know, don't have a lot in common, but they compete against each other as much as they compete with each other. You know, they know what's at stake. Whereas that women's team, they are truly happy for that person who wins. But when you watch them guys, you know, they're looking over to see if they won. And if they didn't win, they're looking to see if the camera's on them, so, you know, they can't show their disappointment.
Yeah. And again, I'm not trying to say that Missy Franklin is not a competitor or she's any less competitive because she's a female, but I think that there's an element of that where no matter what she does, you know, she's doing it for a different reason other than competing. And if she were a guy, I think we would go in on her differently. Because going to college, again, who are you going to swim against in college that's going to give you a game? You know what I mean? You just busted the heads of everybody in the world. Who giving you a game in Florida? You know, who finna get in the pool? Who's seeing you in the pool in Florida? You just smashed everybody in the world.
But see, you
smashed the best in the world.
Here again lies that different dynamic, because she seems to be the type of person, she don't even want to be the captain of the team. She just wants to be a part of it. And a male swimmer, 17 years old, you know he wants to be the captain. He gonna tell the coach what to do. You know, it's a different dynamic. It's a different.
Yeah, and I think from a media perspective, we would approach it differently if she were a male athlete, given our expectations upon male athletes. Now, I also fall in the same vein as LT. I do admire what her family's doing, but I also understand they're coming from a place of privilege. If it was my daughter, I think I would say this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. Your athletic ability is something that is finite. You know what I mean? It's something that, you know, you can, you know, when the next Olympics rolls around, you'll be 21. One, you can still go to college and train. You can still go to college and work towards the Olympics. You can still have that college experience. You won't be on the team, but you can still have that college experience. It's a tough balance because you want kids to be well-rounded. You want them to have those life experiences. But at the same time, you know, the physical gifts that she has are finite, and they're going to go away at some point. And you want to maximize, just like if she were a chemist, you know, if she were real good at chemistry, we would say, you know, if you have an opportunity to work, you know, at the number one chemistry lab in the world or go to college and study chemistry, what should you do? You should probably take the opportunity that makes the most sense, which would be going to work at the number one chemistry lab in the world.
Right.
You know, I think we would have a different view if it were something like chemistry that was more kind of intellect. We would have a different view of it. You know what I mean? And that's not something that's finite. You know, what you know is what you know, and you're gonna know it as long as you live.
Right.
You know, but athletic ability again, I think is something finite. And yes, we want her to be a kid. Her parents want her to be a kid. They want her to have that experience. But again, it goes away, and when it's gone, it's gone. So it's an interesting conversation. Looking to the world of parenting and advice, and then also just comparing competition and how we view competitiveness across genders. I think it's an interesting case study for that, because I think again, if she were a young man, I think the media would have a different approach to the way they talk about her decision to not go pro. When they do, given that she's a female. Again, it's an interesting case study, an interesting situation to talk about. On to the next Olympic athlete, we got Gabby Douglas. Gabby Douglas won an all-around gold medal in gymnastics, led Team USA to a gold medal, kind of slipped up a little bit on the uneven bars and the balance beam. But overall, she's had a great Olympics. Sparked up a little controversy about her hair, and I just want to take a moment and say, people, please. Any grown adult that's worried about this young lady's hair, you need to be slapped. If you have a relative who's sitting next to you and you said anything derogatory about Gabby Douglas's hair during this competition, please allow the person sitting next to you to slap you twice. All right, that's just off general principle. You should be slapped twice. This is a young lady who is competing, and I don't know. Maybe you guys, maybe the people who were criticizing her hair were not athletes, but for young women, particularly young African American women, if you competing and you sweating, your perm ain't gonna hold up. Right? You ever heard the phrase "sweat your perm out"? When you're an athlete, you do that all the time, okay? And she had to do something with her hair. And gymnasts wear their hair a certain kind of way, all right? If you looked at any of the other gymnasts, their hair was slicked back too. So focus on what's important. The young lady won a gold medal for her country. That's the most important thing in the situation. I know we live in the Twitter age. I know we live in the Facebook age, and everybody's fair game. But people, be adults, right? Be adults. Let's focus on what's important, and it's not her hair. I know that's a big deal. In the African-American community, hair is a big deal. I get that. But again, she's in a competition. She's sweating. She's competing. She's not worried about maintaining her hair in that situation. Plus, she's in London, right? So, I mean, she's not really in a position where she can go get her hair done. All right, it just doesn't work that way. So for those people who criticize Gabby Douglas for the way she kept up her hair during the Olympic Games, I'm going to assume that you're an athlete and you never competed and you just don't have a clue, because even as a guy, you know, I can get a fresh haircut before the game, and I can have my wave when I had hair. I can have my waves laid nicely. At the start of the game, you know, I brush my hair. You get in the mirror in the locker room, brush your hair. At the end of the game, your waves is not spinning like they were before the game. That's just the way it works. All right? It's just a casualty of war. You know what I mean? And it's the same way. It's even more evident with the ladies. So, again, I just shake my head at the folks that did that. That's poor taste. But what I do want to say is I know PhD, you sent some emotionally charged text when Miss Douglas won. Just reflect on that moment when you were able to watch her perform and her really uplift that team and really take that team to another level.
Well, it's the same way I was when, you know, Venus Williams won her first Grand Slam when we were in college. You know, it was just something like, wow, this is something we've never seen in our generation in terms of an African-American dominating in this sport that is, you know, predominantly dominated by non-minorities. So, and I felt the same way about Tiger Woods, like a lot of people did. And, you know, while we've seen, you know, African-American gymnasts do very well in the Olympics, talk about Dominique Dawes, we haven't seen someone do this well on an individual level where she won the all around. So, you know, it was my mother was calling me, did you see this? And I'm like, well, it's tape. And she just couldn't help herself. She just had to let me know exactly what. I'm a grown man with my own family. My own mortgage, my own bills, but when mama got something to say, you don't really tell her twice that it's tape. You just listen. So, I mean, that was just my thing, man. It was just so impressive, and I'm with you, Marcus. This whole discussion about her hair, let's get over it. Yeah, Chris Rock made a movie about it, but let's get over it. Let's get past it and look at what she's accomplished as a gymnast, because it's extremely impressive.
Well said. Ray, you got any thoughts on this?
Like you said, the fact that this is the first young African American girl to achieve this kind of greatness. You know, you have to wonder how many. 6, 7, 8-year-old young black girls are out there just looking at that going, see, that I can do that. I can have that chance. I can do that same thing. And hopefully all the tweets and the confusion about the hair don't stop them, you know, because they're also girls, you know, and they don't want to hear that. You know, it might generate to something else. But the idea that she set this precedent and she – And her story, you know, how she had to leave her family, go to Iowa. I mean, it's not everyone would do that, you know. It wasn't down to Texas with Caroli. It was to Iowa. That's what she could do. And from there, you know, she got to where she is. I mean, it's a real great story. And, you know, it's just of the beginning of what we can expect in the future. There are a lot of young kids out there that may not have thought gymnastics was for them. And now they realize that gymnastics is indeed for them.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I have a son who watched Johnny Orozco perform, and he got excited to see somebody that looked like him doing flips. He liked, you know, my son's small. He likes to flip. He has a gymnast build. So that was cool for him. You know, and I agree. Yeah. I think that's going open some young people's eyes to opportunities and make their world a bit bigger. Real quick, we're going to wrap up our Olympic conversation. You're listening to The Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com. We're talking about the Olympics, and we're going to get into new things that we've learned about sports that weren't on our radar during the Olympic season. I'm going to kick this one off. I have a couple. Number one, I did not know you could kick in volleyball. Like, you could kick the ball in volleyball. Did not know that. Saw it on two occasions. One occasion, the first time I saw it was in the women's volleyball between Brazil, I think it was Turkey. One of the Brazilian young ladies, the ball was kicked way, I mean, it was hit way out of bounds. Not kicked, it was hit way out of bounds. And in order to save it back in place, he bicycle kicked the ball to her teammates. It was crazy. It was one of the most athletic things I've ever seen, but it was also one of the craziest, most unexpected things I've ever seen. So that's something new, right? You can kick in volleyball. I also saw the men, the USA, Team USA men do it against Russia in the game, in a match that they lost. One of the guys actually popped it up with his foot into a perfect set that led to a spike for points. That led to a kill. So that was also amazing and well-timed and well-executed. But I didn't know that. Water polo has really caught my attention this Olympics. You know, I'm not a great swimmer. I'm black. I swim well enough to survive, okay? But I'm watching water polo, and the whole time I'm watching, I'm thinking, man, I'd have to punch somebody, man. They keep dunking each other. They keep dunking each other in the water. And as I'm watching and they continue to dunk one another, I see that they're getting called for fouls. And so they would dunk someone. Like anytime you got a little too rough, a little too exciting, a little too aggressive, they send you into a little penalty box. And in the penalty box, you got subbed out. You didn't just go sit in the penalty box. You had to come out the game. Your team had to play without you for a certain amount of time. So that was something that I learned. And then this other sport that I saw, and Ray, you saw this one with me, man. You can help me explain it to the people out there. But it's indoor cycling, the sprint. And this was the most unexpected. It's a sprint race. And so the race starts, and what you have is you have the two cyclists. One gets to go out in front, and the other one comes behind them. And the race started, I'm expecting, you know, it's a sprint. They're going to be flying around this track. You know, I've seen it before. They ride these bikes with no brakes. They can't even take their feet off. Their feet are attached to the pedals. They have to have people staring them up. I'm like, okay, this is gonna be crazy. They're gonna really be flying around this track. And it starts out, and they're crawling. I mean, like literally crawling. I mean, going like less than a mile per hour. And I'm like, this is supposed to be a sprint. And the whole time, the guy in front is looking back. He's checking over his shoulders to see the guy behind him. And the whole strategy of it is, to make a long story short, the whole strategy of it is that the person in second place, they go around at this pace for about a lap. And then the guy in second place makes a move. And he's trying to get into a position where he can sneak by. And the guy in front is trying to anticipate when that's going to be. So there's this cat and mouse game going back and forth throughout the first lap. And then the last two laps, usually around somewhere about halfway through, before the halfway point of the second lap, the second guy will make his move. And then it's on. And, I mean, it is on. And these dudes are flying up to about 60-some miles per hour on bikes, trying, like, to cut each other off. It's the most crazy, exciting thing you've ever seen. But for the first lap, it is like, man, what are y'all doing? Are y'all for real? This is supposed to be a race. You looking back and you're not even trying, and it was just it was one of those unexpected things that I thought it really caught me off guard.
And until you saw the start of the race, where that first racer was actually in front, you thought there was some kind of handicap because he is a full length. You thought he is a full bike length ahead of the guy in front of him, and you would see that gun go off. And that guy would just jet out. I would have jetted out. I'm like, I'm already a length ahead. We have to be close. Physically, we have to be close. We're both Olympians.
Yeah.
I should be conditioned enough to just jet out and lead this guy. And that's not the – you wonder if being in front is actually the preferred position. Because what happens is if they're waiting for that moment that they can shoot down that track and get that momentum going.
Yeah.
And if you shoot down too fast, you know, and you can watch two or three of these races, and I really can tell you that I don't understand the strategy. Because to me, you would want to be that guy in front.
Yeah.
You just wanted to watch one race where they started the race and that guy just took off. You know? He's already in front. It just makes sense to me. It's like make somebody do it for him, you know? Just take off. Make him catch.
Yeah, I agree.
You have to have the same athletic ability, but it's not like that at all. And you watch it, and then you got to watch it again because you're like, what was that all about?
Yeah, again, I totally agree, Brad.
Do you understand the strategy? Because I really don't.
I don't understand the strategy. Because I feel like if you're on first, you're totally at the other guys, at the women. You're reactionary the whole time. But that's neither here nor there. We don't have to understand the strategy.
Right,
it's crazy.
Right.
It's not something I'm ever going to do. It's not something you're ever going to do. But I want to throw it to Phil T. PhD, you had one that you wanted to share with us. What do you got, man?
Well, I won't talk again on archery because that was my teaser I gave a couple of weeks ago. But I will spend some time on handball. You know, I'm very thankful for Scott Van Pelt on ESPN Radio of really championing this whole handball movement. I mean, it's a very interesting sport, man. You know, you got seven cats, and it's a lot like basketball, but you got a bigger basket. You know, it's kind of like indoor soccer, but you dribble it like basketball. You know, and the entire rules were just very foreign to me, literally foreign, when I was watching Germany and Denmark play. here's the rule that got me. Players have to stop dribbling within 3 seconds, either pass or shoot. This would not work for Allen Iverson. It would not work for Allen Iverson.
It would work for Iverson, Marbury, Steve Francis. Yes, sir. Okay, so handball. I'm gonna have to check handball. I haven't had a chance opportunity to get a glimpse of what's going on in the handball world. But there's been a lot of sports that we've been exposed to over these 2 weeks that the Olympics happens that I won't watch again for another 4 years. But during these 2 weeks, it is really a joy to watch some of this other stuff that we really don't get to see, no matter how confusing it is. No matter how much we don't understand it, somebody understands it. It just ain't us. All right. So you're listening to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com. Make sure you check us out at realsportsguys.com. Go there. You can download all of our shows. All of our shows are also available on iTunes. Make sure you get those shows downloaded. We've been at this for a while. If you like what you hear tonight, make sure you check it out and get in tune with the Renegades. Now, we're going to move into a segment of our show, the Five on the Black Hand Side. We're going to hit you with that right now.
Five on the Black Hand Side.
Yes, sir. So for this week's edition of the Five on the Black Hand Side, we're going to go into our NFL divisional previews. This week, we're going to cover the NFC East. I'm going to start with Ray, and then I want CLT to jump in, and then I will follow up on this first one. Number one, best team in the division. The division is the NFC East. Ray, best team in the NFC East.
Philadelphia Eagles.
Ooh, the Eagles. Okay. And why so?
I just think that, last year was kind of a fluke. They put together what they felt was a dynamic team. They sputtered. I think they forgot they had to come out and play. I think they were embarrassed to have that much talent on one team and not have any more success than they had. And of course, all of that will be contingent on Michael Vick not turning the ball over and having to win games by himself and get hurt. So I just think they're the best team in that division.
Fantastic. PhD, run with it.
So I'm gonna go with the Giants. Just because nobody shows the Giants any love. You know, these cats have won world championships. They have won two world championships the last 5 years. And I think it all comes down to Eli Manning. We just don't get very excited and fired up about Eli Manning. And perhaps it's because he looks like Eli Manning. I don't know. So I'm going to ride with the Giants. I think that they actually got better in a lot of different areas. You know, yes, they lost Jacobs.
Okay,
but
I was going to say, wait a minute. Didn't they lose Manningham?
yeah, they lost Benningham, they lost Jacobs, but I think the emergence of Victor Cruz is going to help them, as well as they got three guys who were injured most of the season in their defense, in their defensive backfield. Plus, they got their key linebacker back as well. So I think they're going to be better. And Jason Pierre-Paul, guess what? His first year, he was great. Second year, he was even better. And his third year, watch out. So whatever you got three guys like them up front with E. Tuck and O.C., man, just watch out. Now, I like Philly, and I think Philly would be much improved as well. But I'm going to ride with the Giants.
Okay. You do remember that first half of the year last year with them Giants.
I do, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Hey, I am feeling Eli in those I think it's DirecTV or NFL ticket commercials with the shabam, with the little fairy. Yeah, that's funny. Those are funny. Him and Dion, those are funny. I like those.
I think my favorite Manning commercial is when they're taking the tour of ESPN with Archie, with their mom and dad and Peyton and Eli. I kind of like doing the big brother, little brother, hitting each other in the ear and tapping the back of their leg. You know, I think we can all relate to that one.
Sure.
Absolutely. You're spot on with that. We sure can. My team is the Eagles for a lot of the reasons that Ray said. I think if they can show up the middle of that defense, they're going to be a tough team. They have the weapons on offense. We know that. I'm expecting a big year from Mike Vick. I was down on him last year, but I think this is his first camp in a long time where he's had a full camp to prepare. I think he's in the right mental space. He just has a calm about him. He's got good vibes coming off of him. I just feel like he's gonna put in some work this year, and he's going to be a beast. And I like them to go really far this year. So I'm picking the Eagles. Aziza's in the number two, which is how many playoff teams from this division, and who are they? I'll leave this one off there. Ray, why don't you jump in, and PhD, you bring it up from behind.
I'll just say that to me, the only two playoff teams in this division are the Giants and the Eagles. I told you last year I didn't like the Cowboys. I like them even less this year. I think that the Redskins have improved themselves, but not enough to make the playoffs. So I think that it's going to come down to the Giants and the Eagles, and you can't discount either of those teams. So that's it.
Yeah, I got the Giants and the Eagles as well. I would throw the Cowboys in there. I think the Cowboys are 9-7, 8-8 team at best. And if somebody else, if the Vikings, or not the Vikings, but if the Lions and the Bears don't perform the way they should perform, if the Saints falter, if one of those kind of second place teams in one of the other divisions don't really stand up to the expectation that I think I have for them, then I can see the Cowboys sneaking in. But my two solid teams to get in are the Eagles and the Giants. So, PhD, who you got?
Eagles and Giants.
All right. That moves us on to number three. The biggest story in the division, what's the biggest kind of story going on in this division this year? PhD, what is your biggest story in the NFC East, the story that you'll be following the most this year?
Can Philly get it done? Can they get it done, and can they emerge to, A, be a playoff team, and B, make some noise in the playoffs? I think Andy Reid is really, you know, very unfortunate what happened to his son. Let me mention that. But I think he's really on the kind of like the final straw, the final string in terms of the Philly fans really being patient enough for seeing him as a guy who can get them to the promised land. And then also with Michael Vick as well. Michael Vick had this, you know, breakthrough season of a couple of years ago of reemerging as a all-pro type of player, took a step back last year, primarily because he wasn't healthy throughout the season. And so now I think people are going to take a step back and say, okay, Michael Vick, what can you really do? Are you the guy that we saw in 2010, or are you the guy we saw in 2011 that couldn't stay healthy?
Ray, what are your stories?
Well, I think that is the story with the Eagles. You know, the Eagles always seem to be there. You know, when when McNabb was there, they were always there. Now that Vic is in the picture, they're there. And Andy Reid always seems to be the catalyst and making sure that they're there. But it always seems like Andy Reid has those family issues that crop up on him, you know. This isn't new to him. This is just the most tragic, and we'll see how this Eagles team, you know, this team does what the other Eagles teams in the past haven't been able to do. I think the biggest story. I'm really looking forward to seeing RG3 in the pros.
Yeah.
Because for all the comparisons that they're making, you know, they want to compare him to Cam Newton, or they want to compare him to Michael Vick, and I think that's short-sighted. You know, if you're only going to compare him to black quarterbacks, then I think you should compare him to Warren Moon. You know,
yeah.
compare him to a Warren Moon, or maybe, you know, a McNabb or even a Randall Cunningham. This kid can truly play a drop-back quarterback. You know, nobody's questioning that. Nobody questioned that in college. That was exactly the argument they always made between him and Cam Newton, was the fact that they're different players. And this kid is you know, can he take off and run? Sure. But it's just not what he's, you know, intending to do. He's intending to shred this league. And I think he could be the story this year. And then you look at him differently. You're not going to forget Cam Newton. He's going to do his thing. Michael Vick's going to do his thing. I think this young man is just going to do his thing, and people are going, wow, that's a quarterback, you know?
Yeah. I'm excited to see RG3, too, because I think Cam set the bar for rookie quarterbacks at a different place than it's ever been set. And, you know, I want to see what he looks like again. You know, People get lazy and they make comparisons based upon race. Part of that is because you have to get clearance to make cross racial comparisons, and it takes weeks. Once you get the paperwork all filled out, you know, to compare two guys in the league across race, it takes forever. So that's why they don't do it. It just takes too long. The paperwork and all, filling out the paperwork and getting the clearance and getting the okay from the cross racial comparison committee just takes too long. I'm joking. but the story I'm interested in is Tony Romo. I think the clock is ticking. The hourglass is running out on the Romo era in Dallas. And if they can't get something done, if they don't look like they're making progress or heading in the right direction, I think he may be at the end of his rope.
And here's the sad thing. Didn't Romo have his best year ever last year?
Yeah,
I mean, really. I mean, it was the best year he ever had, and Dallas really, really didn't do that well. I mean, and they're not really going to do that well this year. Dallas itself is in a funk. Dallas itself didn't Felix Jones fail the physical?
I think so.
I mean, this whole team is just, you know, Jerry put his mind on that stadium. And let it get away from the team, and they're paying for it. They're suffering for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then one thing that we have to mention on this show, the one thing I can't give the Cowboys love for, didn't Des Bryant beat his mama?
Yeah, he
have you
he
heard it?
Have
you heard
his mama.
This?
Oh yeah, we
have
heard it.
Heard
we
it?
Talked about it.
Okay, I don't get it. Unless
yeah, you
it
can't
was
do
like
that.
Unless it was like an Ike and Tina situation, you know, where you just said, you know, we got into a fight, she lost. You know, I couldn't tell you nothing more. You know, I didn't beat her. Don't think I just went and beat her. You know, realize if I didn't hit back, it would have been, you know, you'd have been hearing about me, you know. And I'll hold judgment until I just heard it as a rumor, you know. But I'm just saying. You beat your mother, I can't give you no love. You deserve to lose.
I agree wholeheartedly. Now we got to rank. We got two more to get through. Let's bust through these real quick. We got to rank the top the QBs in this division. I'll go first with the rankings. I'm going Vic, Manning, Romo, RG3. PhD, who you got?
Vic, Eli, RG3, Romo.
Woo! Ooh, okay, okay. Show us love to RG3. Show us love to RG3. Ray, who you got?
I'm thinking the same way. I think that that RG3 is a better quarterback than you think he is. And even as a rookie, he's going to be in a position to win. Shanahan should put him in a position to win with that running game that he always wants to play.
Wow. Man, you heard it here first. RSG, Renegade Radio, Real Sports Guys, RealSportsGuys.com. RG3 will have a better season than Tony Romo this year. You heard it here first. All right, best coach in the division. Best coach, I will go with I gotta go with Andy Reid. Just look at Kevin Call. Boy, Arizona regretting that trade. He made Kevin Call look like he was an NFL quarterback, and he's obviously not. I think Andy Reid is a great coach. He's the longest tenure coach in the division. I just think he hasn't been able to get over the hump. And it's hard to win in the NFL. It's hard to win in the NFL. But I think, you know, he's won consistently. He hasn't won the big one, but I think it's coming in due time. So Andy Reid is my vote. Ray, who you got? And then PhD, step in.
No, I would vote for the whole entire Giants coaching staff. I think Andy Reid is probably the most football-minded person, but I think what the Giants do is incredible with the talent that they have. But I don't like the head coach, so I ain't even going to say his name. But what they're
doing, I'm not
going to
give that
here,
cat case. I'll just give everybody credit.
Right.
You
but
play
saying,
to win the game.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
You know, nobody likes him, but you don't win Super Bowls like that and not have a follow. So I'll leave it at that. Andy Reid, he's real close.
All right, PhD.
I'm going with Mike Shanahan because...
Hello, you play to win the game.
I mean, this guy did win two championships out in Denver. They're perennial playoff teams. He hasn't had a lot of talent in Washington, but he's getting it. And I think they're going to make some noise this year.
Okay. So that's the five on the black hand side. We're gonna keep track of these and see how well our predictions go. I'm writing these down. I got these documented. So, you know, we got best team in the division, playoff teams. We got the quarterback rankings. We're going to keep track of those. Real good stuff right there. That was the five on the black hand side. This is the Real Sports Guys, RSG Renegade Radio, brought to you by Resistance Digital, by the way. So, fellas, we got a little bit of time here before we get into the Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. I just want to check in. Fantasy football season is ramping up. We're trying to put together, for the fans out there, we're trying to put together a fantasy preview show. We like to have Ray kind of quarterback that with us and get going with that so that we have that prepared for the people out there. To get you ready for the fantasy football season, I just want to check in with the fellas. How many leagues are you guys in, Ray? How many leagues are you in?
I'll only play about three this year.
Oh yeah, so you're in about three. Okay, Phil, how about yourself?
I'm in two, and really, a bit more than one is really pressing me.
Okay, well, I'm gonna be in about four. I'm gonna be in about four leagues. I always do four. Three for money, one for just fun. And that's how I roll. So here we go. We're gonna get into the Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Now we're gonna get into our Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Resistance Digital Solutions. Are you tired of running to the boys in blue? Are you done with listening to sales staff trying to upsell you technology that you don't need? We've all been there. So, what did the Real Sports Guys do? We contacted Resistance Digital Solutions for all our technology needs. They are not there to meet sales quotas or make profit margins. They simply just want to sell you what you need at a fair price. From iPads to PCs to flat screens, TVs, or intricate home theater systems,
They customize every solution based on your needs. Check out their website at www.resistancedigital.com or email them at sales@resistancedigital.com for your custom technology solutions today. All right, so we got the Resistance Digital Dog of the Week, PhD.
We need more dogs.
So my dog of the week, and it pains me to say this, is Justin Verlander. He struck out 14 of my beloved Yankees last night. Inside the park host, RJ Page, you know, he's a season ticket holder for the Tigers, and we were texting before the game, and, you know, the last text I sent him was, yeah, I'm watching the game on ESPN. I'm pretty sure he was at the game. And when Verlander pretty much struck out the side, I didn't send any other text. I was just kind of like, okay, it's just not going to be our night tonight. So Justin Verlander, my dog of the week.
Okay, Ray, my man.
We need more dogs.
I'm just going to go simple with old Michael Phelps. I think once you realize what he really did for all the Olympics that he was in, you'll just simply remember him as somebody who went to work every day. One of the interviews that I saw last week with him, one of the interviewers said, you know, it just doesn't seem like you have the dominance this year. And I thought, you know, how long can you have that kind of dominance? You know, he didn't have the Olympics that you would have put in a fairy tale for an ending. But just to have an ending that leaves you with more medals than anybody ever won, certainly it's just not an athlete that you're ever going to forget.
All right. I got the last one.
We need more dogs.
All right. Mine is Gabby Douglas. Again, props, hats off to the young lady for holding it down, breaking down barriers, following the footsteps of Dominique Dawes, repping for the sisters in gymnastics, and, again, opening our children's eyes to opportunities that they may not have thought are out there. So hats off to her, and come on, y'all, leave this girl hair alone. All right, so that's the Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Phil, can you hit him off with a preview of next week's show?
Yeah, next week we're going to be getting into more college football, as well as dig a bit deeper into our NFL preview. This is something y'all want to listen to. Last year, y'all all remember my Sam Bradford MVP prediction. So the next couple of weeks, you're going to want to listen, because the fellas probably going to get pretty tough on me, because I already know who I'm picking for the MVP, and it's going to be a doozy. In the Inside the Park crew, our baseball show that comes on Wednesday, 8:30 Central, tomorrow, RJ, Hank, and Michael, they'll be talking about, which they started this conversation last week, which was pretty interesting, is they said, okay, if you can pick an outfield, three guys that are all in the Hall of Fame, who would you go with? And Michael went with Hank. He went with Babe Ruth. He went with Williams from Boston. And then surprisingly, he went with Ricky Henderson in center field. So just a great conversation they had last week. They'll carry that on. But again, you've been listening to the Real Sports Guys on realsportsguys.com. Ray, we really enjoyed having you, man. Any closing comments you have?
Well, just that it's been a great evening. I'm glad to be back. Glad to be back in the fold. I needed it tonight.
There you go. Yes, sir. Yeah, Real Sports Guys of realsportsguys.com. We'll be back next week, Tuesday, 8:30 Central to 10:30 Central. Also, be on the lookout for our fantasy football preview that will be featured Ray coming up in a couple of weeks. Have a nice one, and until next week.